I asked this question many years ago, and that was the kind of answer that I got.
Yeah, we're all speculating on this one. Let me ask you, Mel. Mel, I bet you in your youth, in your fist-fed youth, you must have been putting some screwdrivers across oil-filled capacitors and having some fun in your basement in the very beginning. I'll bet you did that. I bet you've seen some of this. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Boy, I was fooled a number of times. You know, you discharge the power supply and start working on it, and then you get a good shock. You say, what's going on here? How could this happen? Where's it coming from? But, that used to be there. We used to call it residual charge on the capacitor. And we used to have contests. I was forget, I had a friend, later on became a physicist, Dr. Ross. Joel Ross, who became a sound key, unfortunately, about a year ago, K2HXS. We used to have a contest, and he devised one method to make it very loud. He took it. The idea was to charge the capacitor with a 90-volt B battery, and then turn this, put something across it and see. We used to call it, who makes the loudest spat? S-P-A-T, we used to call it the loudest spat. And he devised a method to use a cover from a, when he cooked. And when cookie came in this metal can, you turn the cover upside down and you dust charged on that. For some reason, it was very loud. But there was always that thought in my mind. In fact, I remember when I built a relaxation oscillator using an NE2 neon lamp and was able to keep it going with the charge capacitor. And then when it would fade out, you disconnect it momentarily for a little while and come back and then reconnect it, the oscillator start in again, take over.
Hey, I got one for you. Yeah, and also those little NE2 bulbs are light sensitive. In a dark room, it flashes at a different rate than in a bright room. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, one thing, one of my transmitters has a 1-farad capacitor in a high voltage that's on 30,000 volts. We always ship that capacitor grounded, with a wire between a hot terminal and ground. Although, when working on a transmitter, once you've discharged it, and actually, you discharge it by whacking it, although there is a bleeder assembly in there that's still on it, you still take the nice little rod and discharge it, because you're putting your hands in there before you feel like it's safe, so. And I've not experienced that come back up, but then again, I think there's like a 6 megohm bleeder that's constantly there. But the question that I have for you, which is really cool, and this may go along with this, rather than let's talk about a capacitor, most people who worked on televisions with picture tubes, with CRTs, you discharge the CRT, you know it's discharged, you leave the thing clipped to ground or between the cathode and the anode. You let go of that clip, come back about 10 minutes later, you can draw an arc out of it.
I've done that when I was back in television repair. So as you can see, Wesley, capacitors have got a strange way of storing energy, storing charge, storing energy in ways that are not obvious, that when you discharge it, you're not really discharging all of it. I suspect inductors under certain conditions can also do it. And this may be some of the phenomena that Tesla was seeing, that you're seeing. And also, you said something in your last transmission that I'd like you to run by one more time. I think you said you put 2.7 watts into one of your pieces of apparatus with no other source of energy, and you managed to take a 150-watt light bulb up to full brilliance while putting 2.7 watts in. And I presume that 150-watt light bulb was not just an instantaneous discharge, that it was continuous light output. If so, my goodness, that's a significant amount of excess energy, if that's what I thought I heard you say. KE2EJ, here we go, N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, there was a part that was hesitating to say, but I know that I'm making fun of myself and people are not going to believe it, but that's the reason that I changed this piece of material. That's the reason that I contacted this scientist from Russia, and I sent you the full material. I have also the copy for Eric, so he can review it. Yes, no doubt about it. The voltage was about 8 volts. The current was about 0.35 milliamps. I was measuring the power. I have the power meter. Clark has current, volt, and power watt meter. This is a special laboratory design. And actually the company is in New York area. And let me jump. And it was 2.75 watts. It was going down. Now, that power was going to the generator. Full generator was going to flyback. From flyback, it was going to the sparking circuit. And as you see from the explanation of Vladimir, he said that the normal signal is with the diminishing amplitude, and this signal that he says is possible to be obtained is with growing amplitude. And he actually drew two coils, one clockwise, the other one counterclockwise, and he stated that the real capacitance is created by the proper placement of this coil. I had the floppy job, really, and Eric saw this floppy job over there. And I had the 150 light bulb connected. I just simply forgot that I have it connected, and I start the process. All of a sudden, I moved that coil on the ferrite. I moved it a little bit slightly. Everything with this fluffy stuff. That's why I told you about the pancake coil. When you have a higher voltage in between the windings, because the windings are all messed up. And I saw the light bulb starting to light up, which I have never seen this light bulb starting up. And then it was up and up and up and up until it burned. Everything was about 7 seconds, maybe 8 seconds. Or maybe, 8 seconds. Back to you, this. Enter here.
Fascinating. Obviously, we got to buy you some more light bulbs, which you've already got, of course. And I presume this is incandescent 100 or 150 watt light bulb.
Tungsten.
Say that again. A tungsten type bulb? Is that what you said?
Yeah, tungsten is a bulb from Europe.
Okay. And you could tell by the amount of light coming out that it was at least a 100 watt light bulb. It wasn't first of all, 0.35 amperes at 8 volts is 2.8 watts of what you were putting in, and some tremendous amount of, like, 100 watts worth of brilliance that was coming back out. I think Fred signed in, maybe has a question or a comment on this. K1FC, is that who I heard? K2RIW in the TechNet?
Yeah, it is. I was listening earlier. I was about to send you an email, so it's not to waste time, but listening on your discussion of the capacitor acquiring voltage, there is very often physical substances, when they change state from compression, i.e. by the electric phenomena, and I kind of thought that maybe this capacitor recharging itself is really a form of a piezoelectric situation involving the dielectric. Just a thought that I was passing out.
That doesn't work for picture tubes. Yeah, the capacitor was a ceramic type, and they definitely have a piezoelectric effect, and I've seen it. I've seen pulses of square waves put on very low internal resistance type, very small equivalent series resistance ceramic capacitors, and boy, do they sink. An oil-filled capacitor, I'm not positive, but I think it is multiple foils wrapped in paper and all of it soaked in oil inside of that can. And so does oil, transformer-type oil or capacitor oil, It might even be PVC or, you know, some of these exotic substances, not sure. That with the paper, does that constitute a piezoelectric assembly? I'm skeptical, but I vaguely remember reading somebody's explanation for where this recharging phenomenon takes place. But for safety reasons, whenever you're running with high voltage capacitors, do double check that there is either a continuous short circuit across them or at least a bleeder resistor of the proper value before sticking your hand in there. And we've all who've done old-fashioned television service way back in the dark ages, when the outer metal case of the picture tube was the anode and had a high voltage connection going back to the 1B3 rectifier circuit, the flyback circuit and the horizontal deflection and the yoke. You discharge that and you do some work, you clean up the screen and whatever, and all of a sudden you touch something and you get zapped. I've run into that. How does that doorknob capacitor reacquire charge is a darn interesting question. So as Wesley moves, let me drop. As he moves his simultaneous coils, a clockwise coil, a counterclockwise coil, a capacitor between the two, on his ferrite assembly of toroids, which is in a tubular assembly, as he moves the thing around the right way to tune it, to hit probably some form of resonance that's somehow synchronous with the pulses that he's putting in. I think he's saying he's putting in the...
Hey, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
The one thing that you're leaving out of all this is the conservation of energy, okay? There is a... For the lack of a better term, I don't know if Wesley has explained this to you or not, but there is actually a connection to Earth ground, and the theory is that some unknown force is coming up from that Earth ground that actually gives you an increase in the total amount of energy. I mean, if you're taking 2 watts and you're making 150 watts, you have gain there. That gain is going to come from somewhere.
One more thing, there was no capacitor. That's what I explained in the paper that I have sent you. The capacitor was created by the position of the coil.
Yeah, what you're saying is there was no intentional component called capacitor. Although the way you align coils, everything has some straight capacitance. Yeah. It's almost impossible to build a physical network that doesn't also have a capacitor, even though it doesn't show on the schematic diagram. So there's a straight capacitor that combined with even the distributed capacitance within the materials of the toroid, ferrite toroids, the windings themselves, some form of resonance appears to be taking place. And so the Russian Academy of Sciences apparently has seen this effect, reported on it. You're seeing the effect. In other words, you've duplicated a similar machine. You're seeing the effect. And now the mystery is to try to explain where is it coming from, how to optimize it, how to start selling the hardware, how to start selling the excess power.
Not me. This is not me. If I would be able to repeat it and make it work, I don't want any money. I just want everybody to do it.
Okay, that's very altruistic, but... you have reason to believe that if, in the process of retuning the coils, clockwise and counterclockwise coils, so that you saw the energy continuously increase over a 7 or 8 second period, I wonder if you could have stopped that tuning process, that changing process, somewhere along the way, where the light bulb is at 2/3 brilliance, where it's giving you 80 watts of output. It would be interesting to set the apparatus that way and just let it run for some number of hours. If for some number of hours you can run 2.8 watts in and get, let me pick a number, 90 watts output continuously on a lit light bulb and no other source of energy, boy, that would be an interesting thing to just sit there and watch it.
Well, that was done by Kapanovic, who runs the circuit. And that was also repeated by young boy, 19 years old, in Russia. 4 months ago, he published his finding in his video, and so far there is no word from him. No single thank you. Thousands of thousands of people trying to get any word from him.
Hey, Jack.
Yeah, but I'm going to go back to Eric in a minute. He's actually seen the effect. I'm going to ask him for a little more description. But first, go ahead, Eric.
The one thing that's very unscientific about what Wesley is doing is that he is basically, his coils are floating. In essence, they're not anchored by anything. They're not mechanically stable so that they stay in one place. Okay, with the, just considering how the mutual conductance is, the inductance between the two coils and how they're staged on this whole assembly, you know, a thousandth of an inch here or there is going to change everything. Until he makes a really solid, stable, mechanical assembly, it's all just a guessing game.
But back up a little now, Eric. Even though the coils are not mechanically stable, they're capable of shifting around in mysterious ways. For all we know, that's a little bit of a magic. Before he disposed that away, have you seen with your own eyes, and maybe you haven't, and that's perfectly all right, the excess power that he's now reporting? And do you believe he'd be able to set this slightly shaky assembly in a way where he sees the excess power, don't even tune for the maximum where it blows out the bulb, just see the excess power and let it sit there for some period of time. Tape it down, hold it down with string, do something to make it at least steady in that mood. Do you believe that would be possible? Over to you, Eric.
No, sorry to say, I can't say that I've seen it functioning. I mean, I understand, I've looked at what the Russian flyers have had to say. There's also some more missing information as far as you're concerned in this little exercise. But from the understanding that I have from what I see, in order for him to become more successful, he needs to be able to position things a little more precisely. I think what I have seen in the YouTube videos of the Polish guy stuff, which works according to the YouTube video, maybe the guy found the right spot and glued it and taped it down, I couldn't tell you. But because nobody gave him precise instructions that it needs to be a quarter inch from here, or this needs to be that size or this size, he needs to be able to monitor what's going on and carefully, vernially adjust it until he gets the correct response that he's looking for. That's my only thing, because without that, it's a guessing game to start with, and there's more variables in this thing that there's more variables than I would like to have. If I were going to try this experiment, I would take a slightly different approach and make it just a little bit more scientific, so that way I can say, yeah, here's the phenomena. This is what I'm looking for. Maybe I see it just a little teeny bit now. I'll adjust it. Can I make it bigger? It's sort of like you tuning an antenna, you know?
I think I heard NY2H. We'll get to you in a second. So, Wesley, do you believe it's possible to take what you've got and slightly stabilize it so that you can make it sit still, so to speak, with string, tape, rubber bands, or whatever, and sit for some period of time in the excess energy mode where you're putting in something like 2.8 watts and getting something greater than 2.8 watt output? And using a light bulb as an output is a rather nice device, because the light bulb lights up with true RMS power. A number of people who have had YouTube videos where they were using ordinary meter movements, Dawson-Val meter movements, to measure current and voltage in. These are averaging meters, not true RMS meters, and that can lead you astray. But the light coming out of a light bulb, that is true RMS power, real heating power. So do you believe, Wesley, you'll be able to get it into A mode, not necessarily the maximum where it blows things out, just get it into A mode where it gives you excess and make it dwell there for some period of time? Maybe that's one of your next proposed experiments. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Well, having the light bulb to light up, I can see it every day. It's not exterior. But I don't have the access of energy on it. I do see the light bulb going on. As a matter of fact, I was at the John place, and I showed him as well the same material that I have sent you, and Eric saw this material. It sounds reasonable. I would love if you would be able to take a look at it. Now, John, he was able to see another video, not only that video that it shows that the light bulb is working with no access of power, what actually Eric was able to see. But he was able to see another video that was actually based on the simple Tesla coil, but also driven with the square pulses. And I would love if John could say with another additional coil on it, and the Volcom, the tungsten light bulb was held by one of the guys in his hand. John?
Yes, Wesley. You want me to explain that to Dick? Is that what you want?
I think that's what he's asking for. Fred recognized. We'll get to you in a second. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Dick. Make it as quick as I can. What we saw on the video is what looked like a Tesla coil. But the fascinating thing was he had an incandescent tungsten bulb with a copper plate soldered to the bottom of it. It was about 3 square inches. And he held it by the glass in his hand, brought it near the coil, and the bulb lit, the incandescent bulb lit, not a fluorescent. And I did not understand that phenomenon. That really shouldn't have been happening. But that's a video you'd probably be very interested in seeing. Does that about describe it for you, Wesley?
Well, you forgot about the second coil. Remember the second coil that is connected? So you have two coils, similar to my experiment, but it's quite different than done. John?
Yeah, let me drop this in your lap. I don't know if you guys ever tuned up your HF transmitter and put a little loop of wire connected to a light bulb and brought it near the, you know, the 6146 and watch it light up. That's not an unusual effect.
Well, the only thing is that we didn't have anything that was synchronized. This is nothing unusual. This is normal. You have the tuned circuit. Then you have a resonant circuit at the bulb, and yes, it lights up. The thing is that the Tesla coil, which actually was driven by the square wave, so it had a lot of different frequencies on it, at one end had connected another coil. John?
Yes, the use of that coil, I don't know if that was the driven coil or just a tickler coil or what he was, kick coil, but it was a fascinating to see. And the bulb was lighting at full brilliance. It wasn't like when you put a 47 bulb near something, you see it start to glow. This thing actually came up to full brilliance. Accident.
Again, it was 12 volts and not the current on it.
Now, when you bring one lead of an incandescent bulb near an RF circuit and you see light, there is another phenomenon going on here. A well-made light bulb has not just a hard vacuum inside. It has a small amount of inert gas that tries to slow down the amount of evaporation of the tungsten filament. It tries to give the bulb extra life. And any of the noble gases, argon, neon, and whatever, in low pressures with RF voltage across them will give you light, even though the filament itself may not be lighting. I wish I could remember the man who lives in Shoreham. He's a man who does scuba diving. He's got a son that's recently got into ham radio, K2EEK. My mind's going blank. You guys probably know who we're talking about. He used to sign into the TechNet two or three months ago, and he was describing the fact that his father, who gave antenna demonstrations, used this particular kind of a bulb made back in probably in the 1940s, that bulb, when you hold it near an RF circuit, the bulb, an incandescent bulb, would give off light. It was the inert gas inside the bulb, I am guessing, giving that light. So a light bulb near an RF circuit with only one lead connected has another mechanism by which it can give you light. Let's see, who else got some further? I know NY2H wants to give us some further words, and so does K1FC, in that order. NY2H, my mind's going blank. I think it's Lou. Go right ahead, sir. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, K2RIW in the TechNet, NY2H. Good evening, everyone. That phenomenon of a capacitor seemingly self-recharging itself, apparently is known by the term dielectric absorption. If you do a Google search on dielectric absorption, you'll find some write-ups on it. There's one site, designers-guide.org/modeling/DA, that's dog alpha, .pdf, and it's a 19-page PDF on modeling said dielectric absorption. And that's just the comment I have. Go ahead, Dick.
Very fine, Lou. Darn good information. Joe signed in, but we're going to go to Fred first. Fred, you've got some comments on all of this. K1FC. What do those smart guys in Connecticut think is going on here? K2RIW in the tech man.
Yeah. Well, to begin with, there's no way from a YouTube video that you'd ever get me to believe that somebody's getting more power out than they put in yet. Every single thing that I have seen, there was a trick to. Also, on light bulbs, they used to sell in magic stores self-lighting light bulbs. I don't know if they're still around. They were a standard stock and trade for magicians. So having a light bulb that suddenly lights up, the fact is they've got a little battery inside, essentially, to do it. And it's a way of turning them on and off. The glowing inert gas is also plausible, but there's no way. And by the way, there's a $1 billion prize if you can do it right off the bat. If you can prove that you violated the laws of thermodynamics, there is a prize out there. And nobody's come close to collecting it. I'll say, turn it back to you, Dick, and I'm going to retire. K1FC, clear.
Very fine, Fred. You're in good company when you have skepticism about violation of conservation of energy or excess energy and whatever. We all start out with that. But there's a darn many YouTubes. There are a darn many circuits being built by people in 15 different countries around the world. Something is going on here that's not thoroughly being understood. Wesley's going to come close to getting to the bottom of it. You just give him some time. Joe, you want to make a comment on this? And then pretty soon we got to go over to Mel's mailbag, W2RYY, and then we'll come back to this. W2RYY, T2RYW, you got it, Joe. I'm hearing you on the input, but you're not coming through the machine.
It has always been proven that
so far that, nope, we haven't done it yet. Hopefully, that would be wonderful. Have a little box that would do such a thing, Vic. It would be the answer to a lot of things. Okay, let me let it drop, and then I'm just coming through. Oh, yes, I got something here that's come up a number of times, so that's what we're going to discuss. Let me let it recycle for a second. Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, I've had this from a number of young hams, and they seem to be facing the same situation as one young ham happened to Nora summarize it. He said that he was able to upgrade, and for his birthday he did get a nice little HF rig called the ICOM 7000, and he'd like to try some HF. Problem is, they live in one of these situations. No antennas are out outside, but he does have access from his friend next door apartment to a crawl space. And he'd like to, he says, I can only more or less do it one time. You know, I can't keep going back and forth. What do you suggest for a crawl space antenna? Or just getting on some of the HF bands? See, there's so many articles about this. I'm just wondering, can you think of something offhand that sounds apropos, Dick? Over.
So I think you're saying that he wants to enter the crawl space once because he's got to do it at a careful chosen time so people don't hear the noise he's making as he's walking across the ceilings of adjacent apartments, and he wants to put an antenna that covers all of the HF frequencies. When it comes to receiving any old length of wire with a little bit of a tuning network will give you very good receiving capability. A well-made receiver is extremely forgiving. A clip lead connected to the center conductor of the SO239 on the average receiver will receive with medium quality each one of the HF bands, particularly when the bands are open. And the explanation for why a receiving antenna is so forgiving, that's another whole subject we could get into. If he wants to be able to later transmit through that random length of wire, so to speak, life is a lot more difficult. So when it comes to setting up a wire for reception, he may not even have to leave his apartment as long as it's not a metal shielded building. And yes, you may not get full-scale S-meter deflection on the receiver, but because the background noise on most of the HF frequencies is as high as it is, the signal-to-noise ratio on a partial antenna or a full-size antenna, signal-to-noise ratio could be very similar if the receiver is working correctly. Maybe I've misunderstood about QML. KE2EJ, here we go. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, you know what it is? There have been a number of articles in QST in the past, you know, about so-called attic-type antennas. His problem is basically that he's going through his friend next door, you know, and I guess he can't keep going back and forth trying this and trying that. It's more or less, you know, has to be fairly accurate or maybe, you know, possibility of doing it no more than maybe twice. So he'd like to, you know, more or less get something that he can transmit with, because he did get this ICOM 7000, which is a transceiver. It's a very nice piece of equipment, by the way. So, he'd like to get on the HF bands and see if he can do some HFing. So, is there something that you can think of that really is, as they say, the cat's meow for that type of situation, Dick? Over.
There's another complicating factor going on here, Mel, and that is if the antenna was being hung on a tower or a tree where the majority of the antenna is in free space, there are various kinds of trap dipoles and fan dipoles that work on every single ham band simultaneously. Take that exact same antenna from the air, bring it inside of a building where it now is in the near vicinity of rafters, joists, 2x4s, sheeting, shingles on the roof, wiring within the building. All kinds of things are going to detune the daylight out of that antenna. As such, You have to recognize the fact that an antenna that gives you a good standing wave ratio usually means the antenna has been resonated electronically on that frequency. Build any kind of an antenna you like, maybe a fan dipole, maybe a trap dipole. Use a low enough loss transmission line if you're feeding it in the center, or the right kind of a network that you can feed it at one end. But you might have to use an antenna tuner, because the building itself is going to do all kinds of detuning of that antenna. By way of the antenna tuner, if it has enough range, and they can be homebrewed, if you want to save some money, because they tend to be a little bit pricey, you can force the antenna into resonance on almost every one of those bands. But because there is that much non-predictability of the nearby loading effects of the building, it's going to be very close to the antenna wavelength-wise, that amount of detuning makes it kind of difficult to come up with a good working antenna with one single installation without that antenna tuner. That's my first guess, ML. K2KEY, K2RIW.
AE2CS.
AE2CS recognized, but Mel first.
Yeah, well, the ICOM has a very nice auto tuner that goes along with that radio. Basically, from what I understand, he'd like to go somewhere between 7 and 30 megahertz, in other words, cover 40 to 10 meters. And basically, what he's trying to get at is what kind of antenna should he be looking at? Should he be looking at something that's center-fed, end-fed, some conglomeration? I thought possibly, from your experience over the years, that you would know of some antenna that seems to be a fairly good working antenna. I have a suggestion, because I have heard years ago about similar situations that seem to have taken off with a number of hams, which seems to have faded out because, well, let me let it drop. It seems like, you know, they don't cover enough of this. They should do more of this in magazines like QSB and all, and or in a radio and amateur handbook. There's a lot of these situations now that have come around where you just can't, like you were talking about, you know, being one of the few people, I guess, maybe the only person in the neighborhood that is still using over-the-air television reception. That antennas have disappeared from the roofs. Now, many areas, of most of the places now, that new buildings gone up, of course, there isn't any sign of anything outside that resembles an antenna. So you can't just do as much way of disguising. So they have sort of made it very difficult for amateur radio operators now more than ever, Dick. Over.
Okay, Charlie just signed in AE2CS. He lives on West 181st Street in Manhattan. Maybe he has solved the problem of an antenna in difficult environment, an urban environment. Over to you, Charlie, AE2CS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW from AE2CS, good evening to the net. I did want to make a comment. I've used successfully in various situations, portable situations, and both indoor and outdoor situations, doublets, either fed with ladder line or twin lead. The biggest challenge and problem with a wire antenna, as you mentioned, with tuning is also the fact that you generally lack an adequate counterpoise, and you end up with RF coming back, you know, getting tingly sensations on both the desk and objects in your environment. A lot of RF, you know, within the environment and to your neighbors, and I've had a lot of luck using balanced antennas fed with a twin lead, random lengths of wire, certain combinations of length of transmission line and wire won't work very well, but generally, almost any length of wire doesn't have to be fed on the center, but fed with a balanced line, TV twin lead, 300 ohm twin lead will work great, up to, you know, 100, 200, 300 watts even. And, you know, it's available, still available in some Radio Shacks, and it's certainly available online. That's about all I had to say, but I did want to add that, and I'm using such an antenna, and it works very well for me. Back to the net, AE2CS.
Don, good information, Charlie. And what you just said aligns very nicely with what Rich N2EO has experimented with over the years. He has taken, for instance, an 80-meter dipole and fed it on twice the frequency, 40 meters, where the center impedance, instead of being 70 ohms, probably went to 3,000 ohms, and he had an extremely high standing wave ratio because he's using it on the wrong band. And when he fed it with coax into an antenna tuner, he got rather mediocre response. As soon as he went over to lateral line and twin lead, it is extremely forgiving. So you can tolerate extremely high standing wave ratios if it is a open wire or twin lead or lateral line-like transmission line. That into the right kind of an antenna tuner that has enough range will make almost anything work. And by making it a real doublet, you're supplying your own counterpoise within the antenna. It doesn't depend on any other kind of a ground plane or counterpoise within the building. So that gives you a lot of adaptability. And even if your particular, even if your particular antenna tuner has some limitation, with any reasonable design of an antenna tuner, you'd like to believe it can match every single possible impedance from nearly zero ohms to nearly infinity in ohms, and the same thing with all the possible capacitance and inductive reactance. In reality, every reasonable antenna tuner, you can map out what it can cover, and you're going to cover a certain amount of area of the Smith chart. You're not going to cover the whole Smith chart. So even if at worst one of the bands falls into an area on the Smith chart where your particular antenna tuner cannot hack it, by taking the transmission line that is already in place and simply extending it, adding another piece of transmission line in the shack, it rotates your crazy impedance to a different location on the Smith chart. If your particular dot on the Smith chart is three-quarters of the way from the center toward the perimeter and it's up at 1 o'clock, and that happens to be one of the areas where your particular antenna tuner doesn't hack it, and now you add an extra length of transmission line of the exact same kind, it's the equivalent of taking your compass and swinging that dot clockwise on the Smith chart, and now it's going to enter an area where your antenna tuner does work, even without redesigning the antenna tuner. So by way of doublet-like antennas, is what Charlie is suggesting, by way of twin lead-like transmission lines, that in turn with an antenna tuner, even a medium-quality antenna tuner, not one that covers the 98% of the Smith chart, so to speak, that is a very viable operation for transmitting and receiving. It's very adaptable to your particular apartment situation. Not a bad suggestion, Charlie. What do you think of that one, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, back in the day, so first of all, when you had the old rig, I happened to have a rig which I still own. I'm putting it on the air once a year on a straight key night called the Johnson Viking 2. And it had a very unique, very evolved circuit in its output tuning final amplifier circuit. Using 26146s, but it used a rotary inductor for the tank coil. It used a number of fixed capacitors that it had in there, a number of variable capacitors. So it actually had a fairly well-designed built-in antenna tuner in it. And a lot of people would come on and say, well, I'm loading up my bed spring, or let me let it drop. Or they'd say, I'm loading up the window frame. Okay, well, things have changed somewhat. But one of the systems that were really popular for a while with a number of the guys was an article that that time was published in one of the magazines, and they were using aluminum foil. They would take aluminum foil, heavy-duty kitchen aluminum foil, and roll that out in the attic along the rafters and just pack it up either with staples, thumbtacks, or whatever, or tape it up, or whatever they did, and made it into what they used to call the aluminum foil U antenna. And, or just run around the attic and appropriately tap it. That was the kind of antenna that for a while became popular with some people in similar situations. So I was wondering, have you ever heard of that, using aluminum foil deck over?
Comment?
Who is the person with comment?
BC2WGD, John.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, a friend of mine has a similar situation, restricted attic space, and not his attic, almost exactly what Mel's talking about. And he put up two slinkies in his neighbor's attic with a ladder line, just basically what you're saying, and it worked fairly well on HF form.
Yeah, I'd be a little bit afraid of aluminum foil as the antenna, Mel. Making good electrical contact to the aluminum foil is a little bit troublesome. You can't solder to it, per se. Yes, there are various ways you can wrap and get so much capacitance that it really is a good contact. But whether you're using a wide conductor or a narrow conductor, that's the main advantage you get out of aluminum foil, I'm not convinced that gives you enough of an improvement. A slinky antenna, simple wire fan dipole-like antennas, even one simple dipole fed with twin lead is capable of tolerating a tremendous amount of standing wave ratio when you've got the right kind of an antenna tuner. So electronic adaptability, that's what you were describing with the Viking 2 transmitter. Back in the days of Heathkit HW100, Viking 2, the Collins equipment, back in the days when we had a real PI network tuning and loading control, built into the final stage of that transmitter really was an extremely wide band antenna tuner. And so at certain phase angles, those rigs that we used to have could tolerate a 15-to-1 standing wave ratio and properly tune it. And we've all suddenly decided we want our rigs to be compact and no tune, and we expressed that need, and Southeast Asia responded and gave us compact rigs with no tune. But now, instead of having tremendous adaptability, you better supply that rig with a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio, or it's going to complain to you. It's going to shut itself off or cut itself back in power to self-protect that final stage. And then the antenna tuner that we used to have as the PI network, now they're selling it back to us again. So history is repeating itself. So once you've accepted the fact that almost any antenna with the right transmission line and a wide enough range of antenna tuner with the right kind of feed line can give you electronic resonance. Once you've got electronic resonance, you're 95% of the way home free to making good radiation. After that, whether or not the buildings in your neighborhood are giving you shielding in certain directions, whether or not your antenna is high enough above the ground to give you good propagation, the number of wavelengths above the ground is the major determining factor as to when you launch that signal. Does it go straight up to the ionosphere and bounce back to you, or does it go off closer to the horizon where you really can get some DX? The majority of that is determined by what is the real altitude of the antenna above what it thinks is ground. Now, really above Earth is the best kind of height above ground, but if you're building this antenna above the roof of a building that's got a huge acre of copper sheet as a flat roof, that antenna is going to think that's the local ground. Who's the person who wanted to make a comment? K2RIW in the TechNet. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, well, aluminum foil, you say the objection is that it's hard to make your contact via feeding system, whether it be open line, coax, or, you know, putting an auto tuner somewhere in the vicinity. You can buy copper, copper aluminum foil that's sold, I believe it uses like a flashing that comes in a roll, very thin copper. Would you object to using, say, I believe it comes down to about maybe 8 inches wide. Would you say that using, say, copper foil then would be ideal situation as versus trying just to launch or just putting in just general wire, you know, copper wire? Would you be better off with the copper foil, Dick? Over.
When you study those curves that are the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, that are either in Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. Also, you can get to them by going to the Yagi information at the bottom of the website of Dr. Tom Williams for the A1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org. You go to that website of Dr. Tom Williams, the bottom of the page, you'll see the Yagi information by K2RIW, and you'll see these curves. And the bottom line of that is that as you increase the width of the radiating structure, you do get some extra bandwidth. But at HF frequencies, even the 8-inch wide copper foil, the number of wavelengths of width is relatively small compared to 80, 40, or 20 meters. So all of that extra expense is going to give you a little bit more bandwidth, but is it worth all the effort as opposed to wire? If your antenna tuner has enough tuning range, and if the wire has reasonable conductivity because it's 14-gauge or 12-gauge house wire, you don't have to worry about the resistance of the wire, per se. So I'm not convinced that the foil makes enough of an improvement to put forth the effort. That's my first guess on that one, Mel. I think we ought to keep it simple, and then at a later time do other experiments with expanding the width. And when it comes to expanding the width, it doesn't have to be a continuous width made out of foil. A caged dipole, or multiple wires side by side held together with some kind of a spacer, will electronically give you the same benefit of the extra width without buying all of that copper. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I'm sure that was going to be the question, like what kind of materials. So you're saying if we take, basically take a piece of copper, number 12 copper wire, or, you know, what's available for house wiring, very cheap, you can get it stranded or solid, whatever you like, you know, in the, any of the hardware places. Now, and just basically cut it as a dipole and feed it with... to a auto tuner and go with that as the bottom line antenna. Just get that up there some way or another, whether you have to do some bending, some, you know, some moving it or this way or that way or whatever, how you manage to manipulate that in there. But you say that's about the best way for us to go without getting into, you know, a lot of rigmarole of going many trips up and down over.
So KC2, QIQ with a comment?
Glenn recognized. As long as you've got reasonable conductivity, 12 or 14 gauge household wire supplies that, as long as you've got a very tolerant transmission line, 300 ohm twin lead, 450 ohm twin lead, ladder line, and as long as you've got an antenna tuner, doesn't have to be automatic, and some of the manual antenna tuners are superior, that is a winning combination. The antenna itself, the doublet, that we're describing, possibly center-fed, doesn't have to lay out flat. It can zigzag all kinds of ways, above and below the rafters, around the corner, and whatever. Even though all of the diagrams in the book show you a doublet as always a horizontally polarized, straight-out piece of wire, completely parallel to the ground, and no sag anywhere. There's nothing magic about any of that. You can zigzag the antenna all kinds of ways, and it'll still perform and give you 98% of the performance you desire. I will admit that as you bend the antenna in exotic ways, the pattern changes slowly, and your normal dipole pattern gets a couple of bumps in it somewhere. The three-dimensional donut, so to speak, of a real pattern in three-dimensional space, it gets a couple of bends and dents. Those are minor perturbations. And although what you're building is different than what you see in the diagrams in the book, don't let that stop you. Now, you've done some experiments, Glenn, with all kinds of very broadband antennas with antenna tuners, probably with open wire-like feed line, and in some cases with ferrite rods involved in some of the operation. So it sounds to me like you've done something similar to what Mel's mailbag is asking for. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, good evening, Dick. Good evening, Mel. Good and everyone on the net tonight. But an antenna that I found for like an attic type of use that's very, very forgiving is basically a full-size loop. If you're using like 14-gauge wire, and it's really like 70 feet on four sides. So in other words, you have 70. So you're winding up with about 280 feet of wire.
But what's interesting about that is that you don't have to lay it out like a full-size loop. You can do like you were saying before, basically just zigzag the loop around the, as you're going around the perimeter of that attic area, staple with a staple gun along an edge and just zigzag it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth until you come around with the return, and then and then just terminate it right on the on your ladder line coming out. And it's amazing how forgiving a 280-foot loop is, even zigzagged and stapled up against the rafters in an attic, and then just bring that ladder line out, and it'll tune up quite well into an antenna tuner and pretty much cover everything from 10 to 160, KC2QIQ.
That requires quite a bit more copper and quite a bit more area available, and as we're hearing, the particular writer to Mel had a crawl space. It sounds to me like it's a very confined, long, linear space. So the real estate to set up a loop may not be there. Mel has done some experimenting with the various unconventional ways of feeding a loop and found all kinds of advantages when you do that. But before you do the exotic feeding techniques, where you start combining common mode and differential modes of putting signals down the twin lead that's feeding the loop, assuming the guy does or doesn't have the real estate to put up the full loop, what, in your opinion, Glenn, is the major advantage of a full area loop as opposed to a rather simple set of wires as a dipole? Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I guess one of the problems I found with dipoles in confined areas are that it's kind of difficult to get any kind of a pattern out of it. You may get it to load up, but what I found in the past is that after a while, the signals that you'll hear out of it are kind of deaf. It's you'll get a match, but you may not hear much of anything once you have a tuned match on that antenna. Where it's kind of interesting that if you take a loop and you just keep on bending it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and kind of zigzag it around everything and tack it in, it's very, very forgiving between tune-up and receive, where the there is a benefit between, say, the... oddly enough, maybe you've got a better explanation for this than I do, but what I found with, like, dipoles that wind up in really ugly positions, that when you tune it for transmit, you lose the receive. And then if you readjust your antenna tuner to bring the receive back, you're way out of a 50 ohm match for your transceiver. Maybe you've got a few words for that one, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, that's a tough one, Glenn, because assuming the receiver is something close to a 50 ohm impedance and the transmitter usually gives best performance when it's loaded with 50 ohm, even though itself is not a 50 ohm source, to see a drastic difference in the way you tune the antenna tuner to get best reception versus best transmission. Well, best transmission is probably defined as low standing wave ratio. Good resonance, good impedance match, and all the power coming out of the transmitter is going to the antenna on one pass. But now when it comes to receiving, depending on how you set up your receiving antenna and antenna tuner, particularly when it's being fed with twin leads, you may or may not have been intentionally setting up differential mode as well as common mode capability in that twin lead feeding antenna tuner. When you do that, let me drop, you're now rotating polarization of the antenna. And because of the lack of reciprocity, in other words, because of the so-called Faraday rotation effect, in other words, a guy in London is sending you a signal. He's sending it with a horizontal dipole. It goes into the ionosphere, which is a mixture of a plasma, that's what the ionosphere is, a plasma plus the Earth's magnetic field. By definition, it's giving you Faraday rotation effect. That signal is going through some number of polarization rotations as it goes to the ionosphere, so that that beautiful horizontally polarized signal launched in London can easily end up in Massapequa as a vertically polarized signal. Now, if you're feeding your antenna, a loop-like antenna, in the conventional differential manner, it is primarily a horizontally polarized receiving antenna, and the signal coming in is vertical, and it's not going to respond. if you would readjust the controls on your tuner to emphasize the common mode signal as opposed to the differential mode signal launched on the twin lead, the antenna becomes much more vertically polarized and therefore starts receiving that signal. That's a guess.